I'm Bridget Smith of Dunham Literary.
And I'm Jennifer Udden from the Donald Moss Literary Agency.
And this is Shipping and Handling.
Welcome back. Before we get started with this week's episode, we'd like to thank everyone who supported the Kickstarter from our guest from 2 weeks ago, CC James and Singularity and Company. The Kickstarter to save the adventure has...
Been fully funded!
Yay! That was a little creepy how we managed to do that in unison without planning it, so 10
and
points us.
In harmony, almost.
Yeah, harmony? Would we call that harmony? I don't know.
Yeah, I was thinking about it while I was, you know, following the Kickstarter to see if they were actually going to make their goal. And it's funny because adventure novels aren't really a thing anymore. It seems to be a subgenre that's gone out of fashion, and I was reading yet another dystopian novel the other day, published book, and thinking, why does this have to be dystopian? When is this going to actually fade out? So are there any subgenres that you are either excited to see more of or hoping will diminish and go into the West?
Well, it's hard because, you know, I love a good apocalypse. I love a good dystopia. So for me, you know, I think the thing to think about is, are things being written as dystopias because dystopias have been popular for so long?
Yeah.
I mean, there's not really a genre that I think, you know, should make a comeback.
Okay.
Because I think that so many of them exist. I mean, for example, I think that adventure novels evolved into thrillers.
Okay.
I mean, I would consider a thriller sort of a grown-up adventure novel. And I think that, you know, the sort of quote-unquote demise of adventure as a genre,
mm-hmm.
I think it has a lot to do with just sort of our changing tastes as a society, where in a lot of ways, those books are kind of wholesome in that they're sort of titillating, but they're not explicit.
Yeah.
In their sort of, you know, violence and sex and stuff. But
that's true.
But now, you know, you can't publish a book that are also as racist as those books were.
I was going to say, it's,
I mean, they're really,
really,
they're really, really fun, and I'm really excited for the books that they're bringing back. But,
yes.
You know, it's, I don't know that, yeah, I don't
they
know.
Are
That's
sort
a good
of
question.
Of a time, and we don't necessarily want that time to return.
Yeah. I mean, you think about, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, when he was trying really hard not to write Sherlock Holmes, he wrote a bunch of adventure stories, and he wrote a bunch of sort of morality tales about, you know, knights and stuff. And he was also really into spiritualism, and in the 19th century there was lots of like spiritualist novels about like contacting the dead and stuff.
And fairies.
as one does.
Yes.
As one does. But yeah, I mean, I think that the subgenre thing is hard.
Yeah. It's especially since it's, this is also sort of happens with paranormal in a way. It's like fantasy is sort of an evergreen genre. It doesn't really, it's not really subject to trends, but there are certain parts of it that come in and out.
Yeah.
And paranormal is sort of on the everyone's tired of list.
But I love it so much. I mean, and that's the trouble is that, you know, I and I'm sure that you encounter this too, you know, I am an agent. I make my money by, well, money. Don't get into publishing for money, kids. You know, that's how I make, you know, my living and my career is by, you know, finding books and selling them. And so many of the things that I love, you know, I couldn't sell to anybody right now because it's, you know, it's like, oh, this is a thing that exists in every iteration, at every imprint.
It's been done, and everyone's got, like, a series 6 deep at this point.
Oh, God. We're going to have to do another episode on series fatigue because I experience it. But, I mean, I think, too, that, you know, I mean, do you ever think that authors write things in genres because they're hot and not necessarily because it's the best need of the story?
I think it's a combination. I think sometimes people see that a genre is trendy and say, oh, my story would fit in this genre, let me try it that way. And I think other times it's less, you know, trend chasing and more just that people are reading a lot of these books in this genre and are very excited about it. And so they want to, they feel inspired to tell one of these stories as well. And of course, by that point, it's Usually too late.
Too late. Sorry. I mean, I think that I wasn't working in publishing when Harry Potter came out. I was still in school. But, you know, I imagine that, I mean, even still, you still have an influx of people being like, this is going to be the next Harry Potter. And I'm like, Harry Potter is a thing.
Yes.
No one is ever going to have the next Harry Potter.
Never going to replace it.
Never. Thank God. I feel like once it has a theme park, like, game over.
You're done. But we're still getting kids at magic schools, which can still be done if you've got a very interesting take on the magic school, but it's very hard to get out of the shadow of Harry Potter. And we're so, the like middle grade and YA fantasy trends are so far away from that at this point that it's hard to even find a place for it in the market.
So what do we say, you know, as agents and, you know, as sort of sometimes writers ourselves, what do we say to people when they're thinking about where to set their story? Because it's hard to sort of be like, well, you know, this shouldn't be a dystopia. People are like, but that's how I wrote it.
That's where
it is. It's like, you know, I don't know how to have that conversation.
Yeah, it's, you should.
I could have it with one of my clients, but I don't think I could have it with someone that I don't represent.
Yeah. Or, you know, published books and being like, instead of this being a dystopia, I wish it had been a fantasy. And everyone's like, well, that's
The dystopia in which Tom Hiddleston and I are not dating.
Dystopian slash realistic contemporary.
Well, where are the trends going? Because I hear different things from all sides. But where do you think that YA and, you know, adult to a certain extent is heading?
YA seems to be heading in a very sort of realistic contemporary direction.
Thanks, John Green.
Yeah.
Thumbs up.
And so there are a lot of people who are very excited about that, because that's always been their favorites and they wish there were more. It was never my favorite either as a kid or now. I just find it hard. It's harder for a realistic novel to hit me in the same way that like a fantasy novel can. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And sometimes I do fall madly in love with contemporary YA novels about people in high school. Also, the fact that it's so different from everything that's been popular over the last decade, I think is making everyone sort of find it a little more fresh than the next iteration of speculative fiction.
Yeah, I mean, and that's tough because, as you said, you know, I don't really get hit a lot by contemporary, you know, there's a couple of notable exceptions, but you know, it's hard, and so for speculative, since that's what I love so much, it's hard to be like, well, this is so great, the writing is so good, this genre is not going anywhere at the moment. I think I just depressed myself. Oh my God,
really depressing.
This is a terrible idea for an episode, but I mean, at the same time, like, you know, I feel like there are books that are landing that are dystopias because, you know, they have a really interesting take, or the writing is really good, or it's got a great character or a great hook.
Everyone has done the dystopian society that looks sort of utopian for some people, and then
you discover it's horrible,
and then you overthrow the government and everything is, you know, terrible again, but a different kind of terrible. And I feel like that has been written so many times that it's really hard to get a new version of that, but sometimes it can happen. And if you get a different twist, a different story within that setting, there was Across the Universe by Beth Revis, I'm not really sure. But it's, you know, it's a spaceship. It's like a dystopia on a spaceship, which is a little bit interesting. Sort of a different, it's got, you know, theoretically a deadline, what's going to happen when they arrive. And then there was, Patrick Ness's Chaos Walking series, which was sort of a dystopia on a different planet, but
it looked kind of like Appalachia.
Yep, just a bit.
Complete with giant evil crocodile. I mean, I love that series.
Oh my God, it's brilliant.
My God, I read it and I was sort of like reading it through like my hands. Like, what's gonna happen?
Yes, but, it's such a distinctive voice, which is part of what makes that so extraordinary.
I mean, I'm trying to think of what other genres, you know, don't exist, like aren't really a thing. I mean, there's westerns to a certain extent. Yeah. But I'm not really a big Western fan.
No,
I think honestly the only reinvention of the Western that has happened in the last 10 years that I've been at all interested in was Firefly.
Yes,
and that's done.
Yeah,
and I think we can all stop like wetting ourselves over Firefly.
Yeah,
now.
It's been a decade.
we can all move on.
It was great. It no longer exists.
Yes, everyone should just give up. Stop sending Fox that hate mail. They've got Sleepy Hollow now. Let's just all forget them.
There is a, this is not really a Western, but if anyone writes a, if I don't write this first, and probably let it sit around in my computer for years and never actually sell it, but if anyone writes a YA historical, that's basically the same story as the song Dust Bowl Dance by Mumford and Sons. If anyone writes that book, send it to me.
You're my favorite. I think I've read that fan fiction. Western is Westerns as a genre, except in romance. Like, I think in romance there's sort of a Western angle going on. But that's a different...
Super 80s at this point, though.
But there's always a little corner of the market that will have a soft spot in its heart for the West.
For the cowboys.
But then you have something like ghost stories. Like, when I grew up, there was, like, a ton of sort of, like...
I remember that.
You know, ghost stories and sort of horror, light horror for children, like Goosebumps and R.L. Stein, and I guess that's the same thing in, like, V.C. Andrews, and, you know, scary stories to read in the dark, and all that stuff. And I feel like there isn't...
There's a small market of horror and ghost stories, and some of them do very well, like Anna Dressed in Blood.
Oh, so good. So good. Have you read her new one?
No, I only read Anna.
Also, best title.
Yes, right?
Anna Dressed in Blood. God. Like, what a great fucking title.
I just want to read it on that alone.
So good. I'm not wild about the cover for that book, but...
But I do love the typeset. Did you read
yes.
it? Yes. Oh my god, it's like slightly
yes.
red.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes. Oh.
Well done, Tor's art department.
They do so well with so many things.
Our production department, I
suppose. Yeah, whatever. It's all good, but... But yeah, it's hard to think about, you know, what is going to be the next thing, because you don't know what the next thing is until it happens.
And then all you can do is just look for brilliant books.
Yeah. Because I think that, you know, no one thought that, I'm sure that, you know, whoever that small press was that picked up E.L. James didn't think that it would be, like, the massive, I'm sure they thought it would do okay.
Yeah.
But I'm sure they didn't expect.
What happened.
What happened. So, who knows?
Yeah. And, man. You know, There are sort of cycles that my boss has talked about this. If you stay in publishing long enough, you start to see the repetition of patterns and how things come and go. And so she wasn't surprised when it became vampires, but she was also like, I would not have picked up Twilight and expected that to be the vampire book.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, do you ever have that moment, getting into the soul-searching part of the podcast, do you ever have that moment when... you know, something you've passed on goes on to sell big, and you're like, did I just not see it, or was I just not the right agent for it? Because there's been a couple of things where I'm like, really?
Yeah.
That did really kind of well, and I'm extremely surprised, and also second-guessing myself.
But, yeah, I know that if I didn't like it well enough to... offer to represent it, I probably would not have sold it as big as the agent who did.
Yeah.
So it might not have been big.
Who knows? Who knows?
Yeah. All I just hope is that one of my books is one of the ones I do see.
Yeah. I mean, that's the exciting thing about being Asian, I think, is that you sort of get to take a chance on so many things and, you know, sometimes it pans out and sometimes it doesn't, but you just got to keep pressing forward. I was talking to one of my clients about this. You know, it was like, you know, and she's like, what if it doesn't work? And I was like, well, then it doesn't work. And we move on with our lives.
You write something new.
And
we sell that instead.
Fingers crossed. But, yeah. I mean, I just get, I think it's easy to tell when you're reading a query what, you know, vein someone has written a book in.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're reading the query and you're sort of like, oh, this seems really familiar. And then it's sort of this cookie cutter, because the cookie cutter is like a whole other that's a whole other kind of terrible, but you know, they can sort of think like, well, it's a dystopian, so it has to have this and it has to have this, and these are the elements that I have to have, or else it's not going to be a dystopian. And I think that that is where I sort of have issues, because if it's sort of like, I have to have something, well, then it's not your story. You're writing something to require imaginary requirements that no one actually has.
One of the things that I have called these is basically genre soup.
You take, genre soup.
You take all the other...
Fantasyland stew.
Yes. You take all the other elements of the other books in your genre and you throw them all in, and each of them is sort of delicious in its own way. And you put them together and you make soup out of it, and it's, you know, still sort of tasty, but it's not as interesting or as flavorful as each of the other ones were on its own. And at that point, you sort of need to look away from the genre that you're writing in. You need to look for inspiration elsewhere and read things from other genres, and maybe you'll, I don't know, find something in a ghost story that will work in your dystopian.
And I think it also, you know, you need to look at your characters and what your characters are doing, because, you know, a lot of times when I'm reading and I'm like, okay, well, this character isn't really doing, this isn't really compelling for me, this isn't working for me, I'm like, well, you know, this character is following the checklist.
Yes.
This is a fantasy novel, and they have to do this, and then they gotta go on this quest, and then they gotta do this. But, you know, if you like, well, what does this character want? What does this character hope to get out of X, Y, and Z? And then you can, you know, sort of free it from, like, but I've made this world, and look at the maps I made, and... Never send a query with a map in it. I got two last week.
Really?
And it wasn't even from the same person. Like, under it, it was, like, the...
Different people?
Yeah.
I've received them with mock covers, which, you know, they're never going to use that, and it doesn't tell me anything about the book, so... Yeah.
It's like, congratulations, you can use Photoshop.
Yes.
Or, congratulations, you wasted money.
Yeah, having someone... that makes me sad.
I've had so many sad emails the last week from... I mean, authors, just calm down. You know, it's hard. Like, publishing is hard.
It
but
is.
The, you know, hiring a publicist before you have an agent, buying a book cover before you've got a book deal.
Yeah.
You know, that's so far... putting the cart before the horse.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough out there. I'm not going to say that it's not, but...
Yeah.
I don't know when this became a BSA on how not to spend your money, but...
It also turned... This is a really depressing podcast. Sorry, guys.
Whatever. Publishing is depressing. And amazing, but also and also depressing.
Well,
I think it's because we don't have any wine this week. We're just, like, really, we're really grumpy.
It's the middle of the afternoon, and...
Yes, well.
Well, to turn it in a more positive direction, is there anything that you see coming up that you're very excited about? Either trend-wise or genre-wise?
You know, nothing kind of springs to mind right now. I think, though, that generally things are moving in a very excellent quality direction.
Yes.
Because I think that, I mean, one of the, I wouldn't call this an upside, but one of the results of the consolidation and sort of things being a little bit more, you know, there's a few more conglomerates, and, you know, you sort of think of things as this is meandering and terrible, but I don't see a lot of books coming out where I'm like, really?
This got published?
You know, I can see, I mean, even with the things that I passed on, you know, usually I passed on it because I'm like, you know, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
Not because it's bad, because if it's bad, it's not going to, like, the market's going to take care of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
The market's going to take care of it, and no one's going to read it. There are some, you know, there's some, you know, digital first presses that are working very hard, and, you know, I'm sure that they're, you know, eventually going to figure it out, but I'm just like, really? You offered on that? Okay. That needs, like, four rounds of revisions, but
sure.
What are you excited about?
I was trying to... I had an answer, like, a minute ago.
Sorry.
Now it's gone.
I made you forget.
Yeah. I am sort of excited to be finding books that appear to fit in with the trends that are hitting. Because I'm starting to find more of those and think and see ones that I find really exciting and fresh. And say, oh, I can't wait to read this. And it fits in with the coming trends. Great.
Yeah. But, well, we have a couple of questions. Should we,
Yeah, let's take a look.
And anytime anyone has any questions about publishing, writing, agenting, anything like that, just shoot us an email at shippingandhandlingpodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter or to our personal Twitters or via Tumblr. Like, there are so many ways. And we want to give you knowledge. We want to keep you from spending money on things you don't need. Okay, so we have two questions from Rena. Actually, our questions this week are both from people who have asked questions in the past. So thank you, Rena and Colton. You get a gold star. And we're not, we promise we're not paying them to ask us questions.
But we're glad our previous answers were helpful to you.
Okay, so Rena asks, how do you feel about re-querying? Janet Reed likes to say that there's no query police, something she will change when elected queen of the known universe, and that a sufficiently changed or updated project can be re-queried without getting agents irritated. I'll tell you what I hate about re-querying.
Okay.
Is the, I have sent my pass, telling you that I'm not interested, and like 2 days later, they're like, I have completely changed the first chapter, would you like to read it again? I cannot tell you how bad of an idea this is.
Yeah. Especially if it's only the first chapter. Like, did you why didn't you revise the entire book? Like,
yeah, or you know, someone replies and says, but it really gets going at, you know, page 10, and if you had requested the whole thing, I would have, you know, I'm like, well, you should start it at page 10 then.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to not like your book. Yeah. I want to like your book.
And the other thing that frustrates me about re-querying is when people don't mention that they're re-querying, and so I look at it and I go, did you forget that you queried me? Am I hallucinating? Did I actually see this before?
Because we do remember that kind of thing. We do have records.
And the other alternative is if it sounds really familiar to me, but you don't mention having queried previously, I'll be like, oh, this sounds like everything else, and it makes it feel more generic than it is. When maybe I'm comparing it to the one that you sent me six months ago. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I think I appreciate is especially if I've given feedback to someone, like, you know, more specific feedback, or if I've, you know, given notes or something, and then I pass on it, and then they come back like 6 months later and they're like, you know, hey, I've done this. I really appreciated your feedback. I've done a little revision. Yeah. You know, that's that kind of thing I always really would pay attention to.
Especially if it's a fairly substantial revision and something that, like, is noticeably different in the query. For example, I had one author, I read her YA, and then she came back about 6 to 9 months later and said, it's now a middle grade. Are you interested in reading it again? And I said, actually, that makes so much more sense. Yes, send it along.
And did you sign them?
We're working on revisions, so we'll see.
Nice. I think too, you know, when you think about re-querying, you know, it's best to conserve efforts. So if you got a generic pass from someone, but you got a more detailed email or letter from someone else, the person who actually, like, used your full name and, you know, maybe
put
said
time and thought into it,
or maybe said, like, if this is the specific thing that didn't work for me, like, that's where I would put my efforts. But if someone just sent you a form rejection,
it's probably the concept at that point is just not connecting with them.
It's just not connecting with them. But although I tend to use my sort of generic pass emails for when people don't follow guidelines, because at that point it's like, I can't even say why I don't like this book because you didn't send me anything about it.
Yep.
Oh, thanks for this Amazon link.
Great. Oh, the other thing is, watch out if you're considering whether or not to re-query someone and you're focusing on people who sent you personalized rejections, watch out for the difference between a very nice form rejection and an actual personalized one.
Yes.
Very nice ones sometimes sound personal, and that's really lovely and very great of the people who send them to make them feel more gentle. But if it doesn't say anything specifically about your project, anything that you can pick out and say, yes, that's specifically about me, and can't apply to anyone else, that's a personalized rejection, and those are more useful.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, when you're thinking about, okay, well, I've sent this to 30 agents and everyone's everyone said no and mm-hmm. it's not landing, you know, maybe you just need to move on to another project.
Yep.
You know, maybe it's not, maybe this project isn't landing, but because there's nothing worse than sort of like, oh, I've been revising this for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh God.
And what you should be doing is while querying, you should not be paying attention to your, you should not be like focusing your efforts on that manuscript anyway. You should be working on something new. Something
exactly. Exciting,
something
exactly.
that isn't getting rejected at the yes. moment.
Yes. Okay. Moving on to her next question. When you, this is kind of a specific question related to contests. When you don't request something from a contest, is it okay to query if the project inquiry changed from the feedback gained in the contest? Well, in that case, I wouldn't mention the contest.
Yeah.
So I guess this is a situation if it was like Pit Mad and I didn't request it.
I would guess this is talking about a contest like on a specific blog with a specific agent judge.
Okay.
And it,
I wouldn't mind.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I would say something like, you know, I participated in this contest. You know, your feedback was really valuable. I hope you'd like to take a look.
Yeah.
You know, I've enclosed the first 5 pages. Like, yeah. That kind of thing, I don't mind.
Yeah.
And but if you say, like, you requested this, I'm like, I remember that contest. And no, I didn't.
Nope.
Not how that works. So.
Yeah, that's, I would agree.
Do you concur? Sweet. Amy asks, how much does age affect category? Can a NA, I guess new adult,
yeah.
age character be the MC of an adult book or a teen the MC of adult?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, just because it happens, your character happens to fall into the, you know, college-aged category doesn't mean the book is going to land as a new adult. All the ones that seem to be hitting are specifically romance. So, yeah, if it's more adult in tone, it can do that. Or if it's more teen in tone, like
I mean,
Fan
technically,
Girl.
Technically, The Secret History by Donna Tartt.
Yeah,
it could technically be a new adult because it's about kids at college, but
yeah.
it's really not. It's also amazing, and everyone should read it.
Just because your novel has a teen protagonist doesn't mean it's YA. It's about the tone and the immediacy of the story and the emotions and all of that. That's what makes it YA. Sometimes people try and make their teen protagonists and tell the story in a very nostalgic way, which doesn't connect with teen readers really at all, because how can they be nostalgic about something they are currently experiencing?
If they were like one of those really insufferable kids. That was mean. Thanks. Thanks for your question, Amy.
Yeah.
Okay. And we have a great question from our friend Kat Przewski. Speaking of R.L. Stine, she...
yeah.
This is the power of Twitter, people. She was tweeting with him, and now there's going to be a new Fear Street novel, so the internet giveth.
Yes.
But Kat asked us to talk about what agents do beyond selling the book.
Haha.
Which is a lot.
A lot, yes. Well, what I do every day is sort of, you know, the... Oh, the mundane little tasks of running the office, plus dealing with royalties that come in, going through the royalty statements and writing checks for the authors, and also I handle permissions for our agency, which is when someone wants to reprint something that they've written, particularly essays or short stories, mm-hmm. Put them in textbooks, that sort of thing. I deal with the contracts for that, negotiations for that, and
because I think that, you know, once you the sort of inciting incident is selling
yeah.
the book,
yes.
and there's a lot that happens before and there's a lot that happens after. So beforehand, you know, we'll give editorial advice,
yeah.
you know, advice on, you know, I've advised some of my clients on setting up websites and how to mm-hmm. manage their sort of online presences, but then once we sell the book. And selling the book also is its own process because, you know...
Sometimes a very long one.
You know, we want to have, you know, we do the research to sort of, to find who we want to send it to.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we find an editor that loves it. And then, you know, once that editor has made an offer, that involves negotiating the terms and making sure that we get the best deal for the author. So that takes a long time.
Yep.
But then there's all the other stuff that once your book exists as a thing, there's lots of ways that your book could be used...
Yeah.
And one part of the agent's job is to manage that and advise the author on how that goes forward. So, like, film stuff and TV stuff, hopefully. I mean, hopefully. Translation,
yeah.
Permissions and reprints and serial rights and all that kind of thing. That's I think,
yeah, that's huge. The things that no one really thinks about outside the publishing industry.
Yeah. I mean, I think of my role a lot of times as being not even necessarily the bad cop, but just the cop. Like, yes. if an author has a question or an issue that they don't really feel, you know, you want the relationship between an author and their editor to be really good.
Yes.
So, you know, in many cases, I prefer, or I hope that I can be the go-between so that if they don't want to be like, I hate this.
Yeah.
That I can be like, you know, the client has an issue. And things like that. And then, you know, if payments aren't coming in, you know, the agent can be like, hello.
The author shouldn't chase that. The author should just be like, oh, look, money.
Money.
Great.
Great.
And the agent could be like, when's the money coming? When's the money coming? When's the money coming?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so then the author doesn't have to look like the money-grubbing bad guy. And you can let the agent be that instead.
I don't mind looking like a money-grubbing bad guy. Oh, yeah.
That's what we're here for.
And I think we also sort of, you know, at least here at my agency, we're very into sort of career advice on sort of thinking about, like, how is this going to affect the rest of your career? Like, what is the next step?
Planning,
what is the next step, and how does that fit in with all the other steps you're going to need to take in your life?
We do that as well.
Oh, yeah. 10 points us. Best agents ever.
Woo.
Okay, I think we have a couple more. Well, actually, we just have one more kind incredibly specific question from Colton. When it comes to selling the subrights to film and television production companies, is there ever a point where an author's work, technically, in parentheses, ceases to belong to them? For instance, does Warner Brothers own Harry Potter now? Could they make films, etc., without J.K. Rowling's consent, or does every author's contract varies?
No, but also
yes, kind of. It depends on the contract. J.K. Rowling is a smart woman.
Yes, so very good agent.
Very good agent. Excellent advice being given there.
Well, very, very wonderful situation. But sometimes, a production company will buy character rights, and then it's not really based on the specific text. It's sort of, especially for television, they'll be able to do the continuing adventures of this character.
And that's why when everyone is like, why can't Fox just bring back Firefly? Or why can't Joss Whedon just kickstart a Firefly movie? It's because they own those rights. They own the character rights to those characters. And he can't do anything without their permission.
Yeah.
So I would say it just depends on the, you know, the deal. Specific. Sorry. Okay, so his next question is basically about adaptations, I guess following on to our great conversation with Ryan last week.
Yeah.
So how, he wants to know, with works like Gregory Maguire's Wicked series, how do adaptations work? And the question is basically, like, can you only do that with dead authors?
Works in the public domain.
Yeah,
really.
Can you only do that with the works in the public domain, or can you do it with, I would say you can't do it with current authors unless you have permission.
Yeah, you need to negotiate with both of them. But also, if Wicked were, the only reason that Wicked actually worked is because Wizard of Oz is in the public domain.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't have been able to publish that book in the first place if it hadn't been available.
Yeah. I mean, there was a famous case in which someone wrote to Kurt Vonnegut and said, I've written this thing, and it's in the voice of, I think, Kilgore Trout, who was a character that Kurt Vonnegut had created. I could be getting that wrong. But he published it, and it was a bestseller. And Kurt Vonnegut freaked out, because he had just written this very sort of slapdash, like, yeah, sure, do what you want. And then it started selling and doing really well. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you have to get explicit permission, and you're unlikely to get it.
Yeah, that's very true, because I mean, what author wants someone else's work based on theirs to be more successful than their work?
I always wonder how Stephenie Meyer feels about 50 Shades of Grey.
She's been very classy about it in public.
Well,
good for her. She said at one point that she was, glad that her work had inspired so much devotion and so many other people's work, and she was just pleased that people were connecting with her work. And I was like, good for you, Stephenie Meyer. Oh my god,
so classy. That's just that's the right answer.
Yeah.
But in in the case of Kurt Vonnegut, I think that came at a point when he was not actually selling that well, so it was sort of like a he wasn't getting any royalties from this book written in the voice of a character he had created.
Yeah.
You know? And I get queries like that a lot. Like, this is a continuation of this series. And I'm like, no, you can't actually do that.
Or you can't finish another author's unfinished work.
I mean, you can just put it up on the internet. You don't charge money for it. I mean, I don't recommend it because it's a lot of effort for something that, you know, you know, I mean, that's why fan works are so crazy. And so, I mean, crazy in a good way. They're so broad and they're so, you know, incredibly specific at the same time. And they're so, you know, you can mash up a million different things because if you're not making money off of it, it's a gray area and you can do what you want. I mean, there's always going to be those authors who are like, I think it's terrible and I don't think it's very creative and I don't think
that makes me sad because they're so missing the point.
Oh my God, it makes me so sad.
These are people who love your work so much that they just want to play in the sandbox.
I know. And
they're not trying to get anything.
George R. R. Martin keeps giving these interviews where he's like, ah, fan fiction. I'm just like, George, come on. Come on, George. Get with it. Get with it. Oh my God. I was thinking about this is apropos of absolutely nothing, but thinking about fan culture and you know, adaptations and stuff. I was watching an interview with, I think it was one of the people, I can't remember who it was in Thor, but I remember back to when we first started this podcast, the episodes that will never be heard by anybody because they're super long and we're a little bit drunk and just really,
not great.
I mean, I had some good zingers, but like,
just rambling nonsense.
Not interesting at all. But at one point we did a, you know, what would the Avengers read thing. And I thought that that might be funny to do again.
Oh man. There was one project recently of someone who just like made different bookshelves of what might be on the shelves in the various Hogwarts houses. Like,
oh, that's so cool.
Here's what Hufflepuffs would read.
Oh, here's what Ravenclaws would read. My God. Hufflepuffs would be like conflict resolution for the for the not clinically insane. What to do when everyone at your school is crazy. A novel.
By Helga. Why do they all keep fighting with each other? This is dumb.
A novel. Yeah, no. Yeah. But, I mean, Tom Hiddleston is probably reading something really endearing and lovely. So, you know, just keep being you.
Yeah. But what is Loki reading?
How to win friends and influence people.
He doesn't need any tips for that.
He doesn't need any tips.
Mind control.
I'm okay. You're the scum of the universe. Self-help books by Loki. # But,
Well, it turns out that we recorded an answer to Colton's last question.
But didn't actually.
Yeah.
Because it didn't air. You have a hair on your.
We recorded that with Cece, and then it was too long. So we deleted it, and we're going to answer it again now.
Okay. So, Colton's first question. When you've requested a full manuscript, at what point do you stop reading? Do you always finish the manuscript or stop once you've reached a point where you know you're not going to represent the author?
Well, what my boss always says is read until you know the answer.
It's so mystical. I feel like she's sitting on a mountain.
So grand and wise.
There's like a stream. And
you will know the answer when you know the answer.
Oh, God.
So I always give a book 10%, which... So when it's, you know, a really long epic fantasy, that could be 60 or 70 pages. Or if it's, you know, quick YA, more like 30 or 40. But if the story hasn't gotten moving by then, or the characters haven't grabbed me yet, or the voice isn't connecting yet, then I don't necessarily think it's productive for me to... If I don't want to read further, then... people who will buy the book aren't going to want to read further.
Yeah.
You have to remember that agents are basically reading your book the same way that anyone who walks into a store and picks it up off the shelf will be reading your book. They'll read the, you know, the summary on the back, and they'll read the first couple of pages and see if they're intrigued enough to want to buy it. And so that's exactly what agents are doing. They're reading your query and they're reading the first few pages and saying, do I want to read the rest of it?
And you know what I always try to do is, since I request things in stages, I usually request 50 pages first and then the full manuscript. I try to read half again as much as the last thing that I requested.
Okay.
So if I read the first 5 pages in the query and I requested the first 50 pages, I try to read, you know, seven or 10 pages. Yeah. And then if I requested 50 and I requested the full manuscript, I try to get to like 75 or 100.
Okay. That makes sense.
Because, you know, that's, to me, is a good gauge of like, if someone's in a bookstore and reading it, like how far could they get standing in front of the shelves? And I'm a fast reader, so like I usually could get to a little more.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like you said, you want to know how you feel about it kind of going in.
I want to be excited to get to the next part. And you know, I also I never used to do that with actual books. Like if I bought them or got them from the library or whatever, I would read the whole thing because I had to and I had it. But now I spend so much of my time reading that I've given up on that. I can't do that anymore. I do that with published books now too. I read until I don't want to pick it up again.
So I was wondering if you have advice for the catch-22 of people wanting action in the very first part of a book versus needing enough information to care about the character. Specifically, can you start out with a shocking bit of action if it's also a shock to the POV character?
Well, what I would recommend for this situation is showing character through action. If you need to start with something that really kicks the story going, show it through the close perspective of that character and let me get to know that character while the action is happening and in their responses to this action. That's a sort of way of blending both of those two needs. Because if it's just, you know, stranger running through an alleyway being chased by someone, I don't care about the stranger, I don't care about the person chasing them, I don't know who I'm supposed to be rooting for. It feels like, you know, the pre-credits section on CSI. I'm not connected to any of these characters.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of writing advice. It's like, start your book off with a bang, and people have taken that literally, and it's like, nope, that's not what they meant.
Nope.
Because, you know, you want to, the first chapter that you spend with someone is the hardest to get right. I mean,
it is.
In a lot of ways, it's the hardest to get right, because you want to know them, you want to know their voice, you want to sort of know their motivations and what they're facing.
Yeah.
And it all has to happen in the space of, like, 7 or 8 pages. Like, you know.
What do they care about? What do they have to lose?
Yeah, it's not a tall order. People can do that.
So easy.
Yeah.
It's tricky, and we understand that, but there are ways of doing that. It just has to be a very personal chapter for your character.
Yeah. And I think that if you find yourself writing the man or the woman rather than giving names, you know, that's an indication that that's not going to be a good.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you have to use epithets, like, we don't care. We don't care. Epithets are my number one enemy. Like, the man. Like, just fucking use his name.
Give me the person.
Rage. Okay. Well, I think that's all the time we have for questions. Hopefully we'll be able to get back and answer the ones that we ended up cutting in a future episode. But, Bridget, what are you reading this week?
I am currently reading The Ladies of Grace Adieu by Susanna Clarke.
Awesome. Love that book.
Yeah. In case you don't know, it's a collection of short stories set in the world of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very cool to see how thoroughly she's built up this world, because they're almost none of them have anything to do with Jonathan Strange or Mr. Norrell. They're all just other things happening at the same time or before or after. And it just really helps build up the world a little bit more. And it's, you know, she's a fantastic writer, so it's a delightful book to read.
Nice. I love her. She's just so great.
She is.
I'm so excited about the movie miniseries version. Yeah. It's going to be so good. Even if it's not good, I'm still going to watch it.
I'll still be excited about it.
Yeah.
Well, what are you reading, Jen?
I'm still halfway through Aelith the Unseen. I took a little break from it. Sometimes I get to this point where I'm like, I can't take any more plot. Like, I need some facts. So right now I'm reading a book about the North African campaign in World War II.
Oh, interesting.
An Army at Dawn by Rick Atkinson.
Okay.
But yeah, it's really interesting, because I think that's a part of World War II that I don't know a lot about.
Yeah.
And I would like to know more. So.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a little dry. It's a little dry right now.
Oh dear.
You know, they haven't
much like the desert.
Oh my God, minus 10,000 points. Although I make trench puns all the time when I'm talking about Guns of August, which is a Barbara Tuchman book about World War One. I was like, yeah, because it gets bogged down right around this like this start of trench warfare, much like World War One. Like, oh, I'm gonna burn in hell. No. Alrighty, well, thank you for listening, and yeah. We hope you will stay tuned next week for our new episode, and this week you should hopefully be able to download us on iTunes. Yes, so once sure. That's up, we'll make an announcement, and we encourage you to rate us, review us, subscribe to us, and tell all your friends about how awesome we are.
Yes, and keep coming back to listen to more.
Alrighty, thanks for listening. Bye! The opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and not those of Dunham Literary Incorporated or the Dalmas Literary Agency. Our website is shippingandhandlingpodcast.com, and we can be reached at shippingandhandlingpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you.